I wanted to say hello to you today and give you some information on a current project that's beginning to come to an end anyway. Those of you that have seen Birth of the Holy Nation 1 and 2, you might not have actually picked up on it, but it covers the historical material from Genesis chapter 12 through the end of Genesis. Takes the Israelites into Egypt and the patriarchal blessing on the nation that Jacob pronounced at the end of his life. I've gone back now at the request of some people to finish Genesis by starting at the beginning. And the book that is wrapping up currently covers Genesis chapter 1 through Genesis chapter 11 up to the time of Abraham, when God begins to unfold the fullness of his plan in the nature of father and son relationships. I'm not compelled to do it, but I often find it's useful to say to you that those who might have read or have attempted it anyway to read Birth of the Holy Nation, that the beginning is a deliberate attempt to unmoor you from your ideas about what it is to be a father or what it is to be a son, to enable you to understand that what God is doing in the earth, beginning with Abraham, was to show us what it's like in the eternal, in the relationship between God the Father and God the Son. So that took a little bit of work, and I know I have plenty of testimony now that that was maybe a bit laborious to read. But again, it's deliberate. If we're going to be the exemplars of a culture in the world that has practically disappeared, then we really owe it to ourselves, actually, to know what that culture is of which we are a part. And in our time, virtually everywhere in the world, and I'll go so far as to say really everywhere in the world, particularly in the last 100 years, but you can go back further than that, the very nature of the relationship between a father and his children has been under severe attack. It's estimated that when Ukraine emerged, for example, from the Soviet period, approximately 40% of the children in Ukraine were either literally or functionally orphans. I mean, they didn't have parents. Whoa. It's not that they were poorly parented. They didn't have parents. In the era when the state owned children as though they were property, then those people who were biologically responsible for bringing children into the world had no rights to those children. Now, let's be fair, the Soviet Union was perfectly happy to allow the children to live with their parents because it made it easier for the Union. You know, you don't want all those kids living in the streets or having to maintain extremely large orphanages. But the state owned the children. Now, that's an extreme example, but it's not a unique example of the nature of what the world has attempted to do. Please understand me, there's not this massive plot to make us all into people whose minds are almost devoid of a concept of a father. But it has been the result of the political systems of the world that that be the case. And it really is almost without regard to which political system we're speaking about. Obviously, I'm an American. I grew up in the United States. I was a soldier in the U.S. Army, all of those kinds of things. For a long time, voted in elections, all the normal things that Americans think of as being part of the privilege of being American. But I've discovered, I was sharing with Santosh and Sheba last evening, I've discovered in meditations and spending time with the Lord that democracy is really kind of like mob rule in slow motion. The worst ideas tend to rise to the top, not the best ones. They're presented as though they were the best, but they're not necessarily the best at all. Now, there are good ideas, I was remembering that, you know, Winston Churchill once said, during the time that he was prime minister in England, that democracy is the worst form of government except for all the others. That's an interesting kind of thing to ponder a little bit. But man's governments, by and large, really don't work. On the one hand, on the other, they always promote a thought system that supports them, or they evolve out of a thought system which they can then tweak to a bit to fit their own particular current political ideas. Men seek to rule men is the point. And it's rarely the case that the governments of men are as benign as they would like for us to believe. Now, please understand, I'm not an anarchist. I'm probably one of the most vigorous proponents of order in the entire world, but it's not the order that we have all become accustomed to thinking about. It is another kind of order, because order as men do it results in government, and government takes the most hideous forms to even its best forms seriously and curtails who you are as an individual in its processes. I don't propose that we should have any other forms than we have in terms of human government. I don't think that's possible. I don't think that what God has done for us can be reduced to any kind of human government. So let me just use that as an opening set of ideas. He himself, God himself, existed before he did anything that we know about. He's given us information on things that he did that pertain primarily to us. We don't know what else he did. He might belong to, he may have bingo nights. I don't know what God did in the eternal realms before he created that which has been created. But we do know some things about him, and those things are useful to us. So this is the kind of background thinking that has had a lot of major impact on the kind of work that I began to do when I started writing. Santosh was talking about my academic career. I'm retired now for nearly 2 years, and that's been a blessing in a sense, because it has given me time to begin to focus on these things that I'm currently working on, hopefully that are useful in the body of Christ. And so that's what I'm doing currently. This newest book has challenged me very significantly, because in trying to deal with such large ideas as the purposes of God in creating the creation, for example, you really become unmoored from normal traditional ideas about God. When you begin to consider why in the world he would do what he has done, nothing that we have believed really provides much of a foundation for those considerations. It doesn't work out particularly well. Not to be overly critical of people who have historically delved into areas that we call theology, I don't want to do that, because there's been a lot of serious work done in trying to understand the human condition. But I've taken the position that the human condition cannot be understood apart from understanding why God did what he did. Now, let me say also that he hasn't given me private, unique information about why he did what he did. But I have a sense of some things that we think probably haven't been looked at very seriously in quite some time. Before I get into that a little bit, let me go back and say, it has never been the case that God did not have in the earth adequate human representation. By which I mean, he's always seen to it that there were people in every single generation, there were people who knew enough about the truth to represent God in the earth. Okay, so that's always been true. For most of us, we just didn't know who they were. We wouldn't have known where to go to find truth. We had many, 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 many variations of truth that were presented to us by people who had an interest in that particular variation of the truth. Again, not to be cruel and harsh, but I have the sense that by and large, when we take people through an educational process that trains them to be pastors of churches, we're in essence subjecting them to a course of study that has been written, prepared, and honed by people who really didn't believe a whole lot of what the Bible has to say of God. And sometimes they didn't even know God. Many godless people have been theologians. The consequence in that system has been that men were trained, and to some extent in more modern times, women were trained to be managers of congregations. That's what they were trained for, to be a manager of a congregation. Along with that, some Bible knowledge that suited the purposes of the organizational system in which those congregations functioned, their context. After a few thousand years, there's been some drift, you might imagine, away from the purest of truths. Now, I'm not going to tell you I have pure truth. That would be characteristically human, but it would also be hubris if I said so. I don't believe that to be the case, but I do believe that we're in a time, you're in a time, and I'm in a time, when we're beginning to peel away the layers of nonsense that have overlain the truth in the religious context, pretty much across the board, really. You know, Marta's here, having been a person who represented one of the largest churches in the world, you know, Roman Catholic. We, by the way, Judy and I have the privilege of being spiritual father to another woman who also named Martha, and who is also an ex-nun. Now, I think that ex-nun is a strange term, because I think the intention was that these ladies stayed there till they died. But nonetheless, we have the two Marthas that we know who decided at some point in their lives, in our Martha's case, relatively early, to leave that. But that's only one of the many variations of systems that men have developed to control, in a sense, and to manage the rollout and the, even to a degree, the evolution of truth as they saw it. So let's be fair. They've done what they could as they saw it. But in that, nonetheless, all through history, beginning with Adam, God has seen to it that there has been at least a man in the earth who could be relied on to be trustworthy enough to handle representing who God is and the truth of who he is and the truth about who we are and so forth. So that's a background. You see, having been a professor for a very long time, we always have to say why we're saying what we're saying. And so because students are typically at university not that interested in what we're saying anyway, and so we need to prepare them. So this is kind of background of the work that I've been doing lately. The Bible, as we have received it, is full of a lot of truth that has layers, layer upon layer upon layer of truth, and many truths, not just a few, but there are certain foundational, fundamental, underlying truths that inhabit all of that. And they remain. And they will remain when everything else has passed away. That's been a guiding principle in my own searches, in my own pilgrimages, if you will. And at my age, you can claim to have maybe had a significant number of pilgrimages. People ask me sometimes, well, you know, things like, when you were a baby, did you have to wear shoes? After all, the earth was cooling then. And my daughter, she didn't really say this, but it's a joke from her time. My older daughter, it was about Sheba's age, who said, Dad, did you have to take history in school? And I said, well, of course. And she said, you mean there was some? You know, that kind of thing. Yeah. So I've endured many, many, many decades. And endure is the right term when you get to be as old as I am. Endure is what you do daily. But in that time, the Lord has taken me on quite a journey. But you know, the journey has been back to the beginning. It's been back to who He is, fundamentally why He's done what He's done. And I want to cover a little bit of that. I can't do everything with you because Judy can tell you, once you scratch the surface with me, looking at these things, it's a many hours long ordeal for you. And I won't do that. I want to be respectful of you and not bore you forever, but I want to give you some of the basic stuff that's coming to surface. Because God did deliberately do what He did. Now, many of us, not all of us that are here, but many of us in this conference maybe have been Christians all our lives, and we've been exposed to Christianity all of our lives. So we have lots of built-up information about a lot of things that relate to the faith. But for the most part, it over time became so simplified that it's not terribly useful. Everything became little Sunday school stories that are extracted from the biblical text, and they're viewed in isolation from the text. Well, that's okay for teaching a morality lesson, but for understanding the dynamics of the nature of God or the nature of man, not terribly useful. The cool little reality plays, but not terribly useful understanding things theologically. I'm going to propose to you that the war between religion and science is a fake war. It shouldn't exist. There are some differences that are not currently easily resolved, but it's not just a all or nothing kind of thing. In fact, if you read the creation cycle, the first chapter of the book of Genesis, the sequence of the creative acts of God looks pretty much like the sequences that science say, or that science claims to be true. The difficulty we have in conversations between science and the people of God is that the high priests of science have said there is no God. And as a result, science has created for itself rules that it must follow in any conversation that it has. And those rules make assumptions about a non-God existence. And so the whole ideas of science have to be built without acknowledging that God might be a player. And that's the real difficulty. That's the real actual nature of our problem. So I'm going to use some terms because I have exposure both to natural and to social sciences, quite a bit of academic exposure. I'm going to use some terms that are going to sound a bit scientific, like evolution. It is apparent that evolution happens, particularly in social systems, but it also happens in natural systems. It's that the definition of evolution has become so skewed in the scientific arena that, for the most part, the sons of God shy away and become offended when that kind of terminology comes out. So as I say some of the things I'm saying, keep in mind that I'm not wanting to offend, but I'm wanting to open us up. I'm wanting us to have more of a sense of the fullness of what God is doing. And let me begin by saying, the creation really was a big bang, but not what you've heard. Because, and here's why I say that. Let me make that clear before you get terribly offended. It did not exist. There was no creation. There was no universe. And then God created it. didn't exist. God created it, and then it existed. And from our perspective, it's a really big thing, the universe is. And it didn't exist, and then God created it, and then it existed. If you just let your mind work with that for a bit, that's rather an astounding set of facts. There wasn't a creation, there wasn't a universe. God created, and then there was a universe. There wasn't, and then there was. Everything happened quickly, instantaneously, because there wasn't, and then there was. You can't have an intermediate phase. You can't have a system whereby things began to sort of partially exist. They either existed or they didn't exist. It was one or the other. So it actually happened quite suddenly, instantaneously, because there wasn't and then there was. My proposition, my current belief is that the creation existed in essentially, or at least the universe, existed in essentially its current format from the moment God created it. From that very moment, it existed as it is. It wasn't that God had to create a really super dense, super energetic particle somewhere and allow the thing to blow up and take 14 billion years to get to where we are. He didn't need that. If he's going to create something out of nothing, why does he need to have a particle blow up? To turn into increasingly more complex things. And that's a starting point. That's one of the little rabbit trails, if you will, one of our idioms here, rabbit trail, meaning something that's not really what you expected and it twists and turns and winds and weaves and goes nowhere. But that idea that the whole universe was created in an instant is a little bit challenging. And I want to go back even further than that and say, why did God do that? It is not true, let me say this at the outset, it is not true that someone gave God a gift of little parts from which he could make a universe. Nobody did that. I don't know that God receives gifts in the eternal. It is true that he took, in a sense, from materials, and that's not the right word, but we don't have a good word, that are uncreated and created that which is created. It is also true that what he created is bigger than the universe. I think you've already heard this. It says, the Bible starts out by saying, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim. In the beginning, God created the heavens. The very first thing it says is God created the heavens. And you could stop there. You could put a period there. In the beginning, God created the heavens. And then it says, and the earth. You could make that into another sentence. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, period. And God created, or created the heavens, period. And then God created the earth, or and God created the earth at the same time, whichever way you want to do that. My point is that he created that which is seen, and he also created that which is not seen, but that exists within the creation. What he created was not only the physical universe that you and I are accustomed to, but he created the heavens, and it was essentially simultaneous, but in fact, the heavens were first, or at least they're first mentioned in Scripture. That's what it says. Bereshit bara Elohim et Hashemayim, the et ha'aretz, the heavens and the earth, in that sequence. Now, there were acts that followed that. While he created all of it instantaneously and simultaneously, he then went to work on the earth itself as the focal point of the creation. See, the universe exists to create a set of forces and a context that makes something like the earth possible to continue. The whole physical universe, think about that. I mean, this is going to make the priests of science crazy. The whole physical universe, God put it in place so that a thing called the earth could function as it should function. And you say, how can it be possible that galaxies that are light years away have anything to do with the earth? They have to do with the forces of the universe. is the universe in the absence of the earth is just a bunch of stuff that has forces in it. That's all it is. In the absence of the earth, that's what the universe is. Just stuff that's out there with gravity and all that kind of stuff working, energy and gravity and light and stuff that, you know, now even physicists are saying that stuff all bends and gets weird out at the extremes. It's because it's in stasis, a relatively good stasis, that permits the earth. Now, why is there an earth? Well, then we got to go back to God's motivations. Why does he want an earth? That he has to create a context of heavens and a universe to place the earth in. Why does he want one of those? Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's a pain. If you think about it, it's kind of awkward. And obviously, I think you know, innately, you know that the reason for that is he wanted sons. So you're the reason, then, in that context, that God created everything. Yeah. How is it that you're the reason for what God created? Well, the answer to that question is in the very character of God himself. In the eternal, God the Father and God the Son exist together. They existed together before the creation happened. Are we okay with that? Mm-hmm. They existed together in a mm-hmm. sort of relationship that we can't fully comprehend. I mean, consider that their relationship exists already, pre-exists all of the creation, in a context that has, for which we have no capacity to understand the fullness of it. We simply can't. We have no capacity for that. Whatever was going on in the eternal, whatever is going on in the eternal now, is simply beyond our capacity for any kind of understanding. But out of that relationship between the Father and the Son, they determined that that was so good, they wanted to do it some more. It was such a good thing that God the Father and God the Son loved each other the way they did, that they want to do more of it. Well, now they had a problem because there wasn't a local orphanage in the eternal where they could go find a son to adopt. God doesn't have a wife, so they couldn't make more children. How was God going to have more sons? And somehow in the counsels of the eternal, please understand, I don't believe this is literally what was going on, but to help us understand, right? We sometimes have to get things to a way that we can understand them. Somehow, the two of them decided that the way to do that would be to create something else that is enough like God the Son that it could be a son to God the Father. Mm.
Awesome.
That make sense?
Yeah.
So, in that counsel between the Father and the Son, and out of the love relationship between the two of them, they decided, on the man thing. In the latter part of Genesis 1, it said, let us make man in our image and in our likeness. It was the Father and the Son together deciding that. The Son, the love of the Father for the Son is one thing. The love of a son for a father is another thing. Mm-hmm. They're not the same thing. Love is not some completely homogeneous thing that we can apply to everything. You may say, I love ice cream, but that's not really a human relationship. Yeah. Ice cream doesn't have any feelings. It doesn't respond to our love for it except to make us chubby. That's all it does. If we really love it, it makes us very chubby. Mm-hmm. And if we really, really love it, it makes us really, really chubby. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the relationship. But what was going on between God the Father and God the Son was so momentous that in their counsel, which we can't understand, except in this bare bones kind of way, they decided that there would be man. They could have done it in a lot of different ways, but they decided that they would make something much like themselves, it says, in the image and likeness of God. Man was created in the image and likeness of God, made to be like God the Father and God the Son. We were made to be like God the Father and God the Son. That's such a such a fundamental idea. Because we have all been raised in a tradition that said, here's almost what the theology I was raised in said anyway. God was skipping along through the universe one day, whistling and having a good time, and he came across a planet that was in really bad shape and these people were a mess, and he said, let me stop and fix that. But that's not what happened. It was his work to begin with. Mm. It was his intention to make something like the Son. God the Father and God the Son together plotted to make a thing like God the Son that God the Father could love, that would love God the Father back in the same way that God the Son loved God the Father. As the Christ loves the Father, we were created to be. But we had to be like him. We had to be like them to make that reasonable. So that's where the Big Bang, my idea of talking about the Big Bang, comes from. The power of the love between God the Father and God the Son, the power inherent in that love, in an instant resulted in the universe and the heavens. In an instant, it resulted in those things. Not just the physical universe, but the heavens as well. And at least two of the heavens are not material, and therefore not in the purview of science or consideration for any kind of sensible ability to deal with them. Sensible meaning direct or indirect observation of them. All of that, simply because God the Father and God the Son loved each other so much. And you're the reason. Mm. Then he created you to love him. God the Father, his motivation in this was that he would love you and expect from you that you would love him as the Christ. God the Son loves God the Father. All of the rest of this is about that. The instantaneous nature of it is just, it really boggles the mind when you consider what science thinks they know, and you know, I'm not quarreling about that, about the extent and the nature of the universe. And we're spending enormous, or have spent anyway, and still are, enormous amounts of money setting up systems for trying to detect whether somebody out there is trying to talk to us. And he already sent us a book. Oh, and by the way, just to make sure that the book made sense to us, he sent us God the Son in the flesh so that we could see what they are really like in the process of determining how we will live. And that's the truth that we're actually dealing with. But there's so many other things. Like, for example, when God created the earth, he created it as a solid planet, but completely covered by water. It was just simply watery. And so it was shapeless, because water doesn't take a shape unless it's in a container. Remember that. You try to make water have a shape in your hand, it doesn't work out very well. You keep pouring a pitcher of water in your hand, it just really won't have a shape. Right? And the earth was completely covered by water when God created it. And it says that in the book, even though you didn't see it. It's in the Bible. It was the next day that God brought land from under the water. He produced land. Now, how many continents do you think God created at the beginning? Well, he only needed one. He actually only needed one continent. Why would he have a bunch of them? It was only going to be one place where man was going to live initially. So he created a single landmass, and then he took that landmass and he went to one area in that landmass and he created a place called Eden, that he called Eden, by the way. That was his name for it. You're going to say to me, how do you know that was God's name for Eden? And I will say back to you, well, what do you think it was called? What do you think he called it? See, God was the only one that was there. He was the only witness to the whole creation. While the process was undergoing, while it was all happening, and all the 6 days were were going through their cycles, and then the days following the creation began to occur, God was the only witness. It must have been the name that God gave the place, because there wasn't anybody else to give it a name. Mm. The cartographers had no reason to give it a name later on. God created it. And so on the landmass, but not the whole landmass, he created a thing called Eden. And then he went to the eastern part of Eden, because east is the direction of holiness. And he created a garden in Eden. Eden wasn't a garden. There was a garden in Eden. That's what it says in the book. See, I don't have to make it up. It's in the book. God created a landmass. He brought a continent out of the water somehow. It was under the water. He brought it out. He created in it, toward the east, a place called Eden. And then he went into Eden, in the eastern part of Eden, and created another thing called the garden. Now, I've just presented you the first picture of the temple, because Eden was a special place. Therefore, it was a holy place. And in the special place, God created a special place. And the special place inside the special place was the Garden of Eden. And that's the Holy of Holies. You see these things? They're there from the very beginning. At the start of the thing, it's all there. Then he took the man, and look what he did with the man. He went over there and he wadded up some dirt. And everywhere in the world where people live, there's dirt. You know, we're busy trying to make sure, cover it all over with asphalt and concrete. There's still a lot of dirt. And when you think of land masses, you inevitably encounter dirt. That's, in some sense, the humblest aspect of the creation, is the dirt. And he took the humblest substance of creation, rolled it up somehow, and probably, let's just for the sake of our discussion imagination, say that it was man-shaped. It had the configuration of a human being. Then what did he do to it? He didn't just touch it and say, live. What he did was he breathed his own breath into it, which is spirit. So now this hunk of dirt's got a spirit, right? The humblest substance of the creation has now become the home of the Spirit of God in the creation. And then he stood it up, in a sense, set the thing down, and it had become a living soul. Let's see, spirit, soul, body, all in one place. This is from the beginning. These are not accidental things. God did this to start out, to get things going. We're having an adjustment of some sort. I don't know what's happening, but we're making an adjustment. Now, the man that he placed in that place was created in his image and in his likeness. We don't suppose that we can make God be anthropomorphic. He's spiritual. In fact, when Jesus spoke of God, he said, God is spirit. God the Father, anyway, and I believe in that instance he's speaking of God the Father, doesn't have a physical body. So fortunately for him, he doesn't look like Santosh and he doesn't look like me, and that's good for him. Physically speaking. See, God's not made out of dirt as we are. Now, we know that the dirt is passing away and the spirit and soul will remain, but I'm kind of overemphasizing this so we get some understanding. So he made this thing and he placed it in Eden, and then he assigned it some work in the Holy of Holies. Now, who goes into the Holy of Holies? A priest, particularly a high priest. So Adam was a priest. And Luke makes it very clear that Adam was the son of God. So this priest is a son of God. in some sense, and Sam has unfolded for us over time in a number of different contexts, the nature of the priesthood of Melchizedek, which is very vital to an understanding of the book of Hebrews in the New Testament. The writer of Hebrews, this is the only truly ambiguous person in all the whole Bible who wrote something. We always say the writer of Hebrews. We don't want to admit that it's Paul because there's some things about it that don't look like Paul's letters, and so we call it the writer of Hebrews. So I'll let it be that. I believe it was Paul, in case you want to know, who wrote it. But anyway, in that book, he comes about three times to help us understand something about the nature of who God the Son in the person of Jesus Christ was in the context of the priesthood, which begins with Adam. Okay. Now, a priest can do one of two things, and we sort of usually have an expectation of both, but one's more important. A priest either represents the deity to the people or the people to the deity. The people are all pretty much homogeneous with one another in that kind of a way of thinking about things. And it's easier for people to understand each other than it is for them to understand the deity. It's almost always the case that the people at least believe the deity can understand the people better than they can understand him. That's why they accept priests or create priests, as the case might be. That's what happened in the northern kingdom of Israel when Jeroboam broke away. He made his own priests. Hired a bunch of Levites and had his own system. So God, at the beginning, placed a man in the creation who was like him. Didn't physically look like him, but he was like God in the presence, in the fact that he had the presence of the Spirit of God in him. And he knew a lot of things, this man did, because he was created in the image and in the likeness of God. That is, not only did he have a lot of similarities to God that you could observe, but he had similarities in his behaviors. He was capable. The Spirit of God was upon him, as in Isaiah 11, for example. He would have represented all of what we now call the fruits of the Spirit, because he was made in the image and likeness of God. He was like God when he got here. It was sensible that he be like God because it was God the Father and God the Son who concocted him to be like God the Son so that he could love God the Father back. So it was sensible that this man would be created not perfect using God as the standard, but perfect in the sense that there was nothing wrong with him at the beginning. He hadn't done anything wrong when he got here. When Adam landed that day and God breathed the breath of life in him, stood him up a living soul, Adam hadn't done anything wrong yet. Right? He had done nothing wrong, and therefore no sin could be found in him yet. So he was pretty much like God the Son. And he was, in fact, Son of God. Now, we don't have a description of how Adam felt about God. You know, we don't really have a description of that beyond the fact that when he and Eve sinned, he hid because he was afraid he would disappoint God. But that's really all we knew about the relationship. But he had a job, and he did his job perfectly. God said, in essence, I'm paraphrasing, God said, I'm going to send animals to you, and when they get there, call them something. So this big animal with a big long neck came along, and Adam said, oh, it's a giraffe. And God said, okay, it's a giraffe. Whatever Adam called it, what God agreed to. Mm-hmm. The man had authority. Mm-hmm. He had the very authority of God. He was, and I've used this term, he is the viceroy of God. When a creature in the earth saw Adam, he saw God. Not literally seeing God, but seeing something that he could accept as having the authority, so that when Adam said a thing, it was as though God himself said it. And God blessed that, because when Adam said, that's a giraffe, God said, then that's a giraffe. Right? Okay? Mm-hmm. You see how that was, I mean, that's a tremendously powerful thing that God set up. And it was to rule the earth. And it was to rule the earth for the benefit of the earth, so that the earth could see literally the physical presence of God in a Son of God who was confined to the physical creation, the physical reality of creation. Wasn't able yet to exist in the eternal with the Father. We'll see the corporate man, I think, eventually do that, exist in the eternal with God the Father. But he created us the way he created us to experience many, 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 many instances of that love relationship I spoke about a few minutes ago. This is his purpose. Why God did what he did was he loved loving his Son, and the Son loved loving him back in response so much that they did this. And in order for this to work, they had to provide a context for it, and that context was a world that needed a context in which it could exist, that it could continue to operate more or less on an ongoing basis for as long as it was necessary that it do so. Now, at the same time, he created the heavens, because he created that. Apparently, we could make the argument anyway that the second was split and the heavens were first and then the earth. We know that it's likely that there are three heavens. Paul speaks of the third heaven. It's sort of human nature to think if there's a third, there must be a first and a second. Why would there be a third otherwise? I mean, third isn't a color or an odor. It's a number. It's a number in cardinal form. I mean, ordinal form. The fact of the matter, then, is that there appear to be three heavens, but I'll propose to you there are only three. And the reason there are only three is because what Paul saw and what John saw and what Daniel saw was a place where the will of God was absolute. And Jesus said, when you pray like this: Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done in the earth as it is done in heaven. Right? I paraphrase that very slightly in the English. Of course, he said it probably not in English, since that language didn't exist in that time. But the translation is reasonable. It's not a hard translation. So God established the heavens as sort of a way of understanding the whole context of man as man relates to the eternal, in that he set up the absolute rule of God in a thing we now call third heaven. And the feature, the featured feature of third heaven is the throne. And the throne represents rule, does it? You know, that's what thrones represent. Mm-hmm. So we have the rule of God in third heaven. We have something we call second heaven, and there appears in second heaven sort of a context within which, among other things, disorder can occur. You know, when Daniel was being visited by an angel, the angel said, I got hung up for a while on the way here by the prince of Persia. Well, the prince of Persia seems to be a servant of the Satan. Jesus said, I saw Satan fall from heaven. And Revelation speaks of a time in Revelation chapter 12 when Satan is cast down into the earth. We glibly read that over as though those two events were the same. They are not. Satan fell from the third heaven into the second heaven. I'm going to come back to that in just a moment. And in the time to come, he will be cast out of the second heaven into the earth. The earth exists in the universe. The physical universe, I believe, is the first heaven. And that just has to do with the language of Genesis 1. Because, for example, in the fourth day, God created the sun and the moon and the stars in the heavens. So we see them, they're natural, they're physical, we observe them. And so there must be a heaven that's tied to the physical. So that's the first heaven. That exists for purposes of maintaining an order of energy and being for the natural thing that is the earth that contains the spiritual thing that is the Son of God. So God saw to it at the most basic level, he was still being represented. Knowing how things would go, he also placed it in a context that gives it access to the place where God's will is absolutely done. Jesus said, "Let your will be done in the earth as it is in heaven." And that means we can understand how God's will is done in third heaven. Not in second heaven. God's will, in a way, is done there, but there's also conflict there. But there's no conflict in third heaven. So this, I've given you kind of a cosmological perspective on the wholeness of what God was doing as a way of saying that it's all very purposeful. Now, Adam, I mentioned a few, I was going to come back to something, and I forgot what I was going to come back to just then. That happens when you get really old. you know, time loses significance, and so does your memory. I mentioned a moment ago I was going to come back to something. You had it?
About the priest?
Yes, the priests. I do want to cover the priests quickly. God would be unreasonable if he expected us to know about him just because he expected us to know about him. And so what he did was when he created the man, when he created Adam, he established a system whereby Adam represented God to the creation. Now, when Adam and Eve had their little moment in which they decided that they would be as wise as God, or at least she did, by eating this particular fruit. From that time, very quickly thereafter, God made the announcement, but it was already a fact, that they would not live forever in their physical format, and that he was actually going to deal with that by putting them out of the Holy of Holies, if you'll remember, giving them no longer access to the tree of life. When Adam was ejected from the Garden of Eden, my strong belief is that he lived the rest of his life in Eden, but not in the garden. Because the only thing God was doing when he ejected Adam was to take away his access to the tree of life. That's all. But now Adam, being already a priest, was consigned to Eden, which is the holy place, but not the Holy of Holies. Then when his son Cain did what he did, he was ejected from the holy place. And he went into the land that existed elsewhere that was under a significantly more stringent curse than was Eden. If you'll remember, when God dealt with Adam, he said, "The land is cursed because of your behavior. And it'll produce for you, but it'll be difficult." When he ejected Cain, he said, "You are cursed from the land. The land is already cursed. Now you're cursed from that. You can't remain in Eden. You must be in another place where the land is even less useful." And in fact, chaos reigned. There was no sense of the presence of God in that land, except whatever Cain remembered, because Adam retained the memory of God in Eden. When Cain left, he no longer had access to that. And Cain was mad at God. It doesn't say that Adam was mad. Adam still at least got to be a priest in the holy place. But Cain was now cast out of from everything that was holy, and chaos reigned in all of that land around Canaan, around Eden, where Cain had been exiled to. The consequence was the knowledge of God was never really fully brought into what I'll call not Eden, all of the rest of the land. But the knowledge of God was as well retained as possible in Eden. Adam fessed up. We have it in Scripture what Adam did wrong. But he was still a priest of God. And then when he had a son named Seth who replaced Abel, he taught him everything he knew about God. Let me really mess with your mind a little bit. There was a day, a time, when God sat down with Adam, in a sense, and he said, now let me tell you about the creation, what I did. And he dictated to Adam, chapter 1 of Genesis. How else would we know it? That's the kind of fellowship that Adam and God had. Even in Eden, God would come and say, this is how it happened. I want you to remember this. Otherwise, we wouldn't have that information, y'all. We really wouldn't. It wouldn't be available to us if God hadn't told Adam about it, right? Mm. Who else would tell him? Mm. You know, there was no one else to tell Adam what God did except God himself. That's the fellowship they had. So let's don't trivialize Adam. He messed up. You know, and I run a slight risk here of getting in trouble with the lady over on the side of the room over here. He messed up when she decided that they wanted to be as smart as God. And he went along with it. But they weren't as smart as God, but they had that kind of fellowship where God would say, let me tell you what I did. Mm-hmm. To get things started, I created the heavens and the earth. And when I first did that, there was no light. And so I sent the sun into the world, and light came. Now, I just said something that I don't think you probably have heard very much about. I sent the sun, who is the light, into the world, and light came to the world. Light was in the creation from that moment. Not the sun and the moon and the stars, but light. Because the sun is the actor in creation. Jesus, God the Son, came into the creation to do the work of creation once the creation came into being. That's in Genesis 1, 2. Genesis chapter 1, verses 1 through about 3. That's all there. You know, it's in the book. Again, it's not like I'm making it up. It's right there in the book that we have. And God saw to it that it was preserved. He dictated it to Adam so it could be kept. Now, what did Adam do with it? He taught it to his son Seth. And when he taught it to his son Seth, Seth now had the knowledge. In the generation of Seth's brothers and sisters, Seth was the one entrusted with the special knowledge, if you will. Or he was not just entrusted with it, but he was expected to maintain it with accuracy and purity. And then Seth had a son named Enosh. And guess what Seth did? Among all of his sons, he chose Enosh, and he gave him the full, accurate knowledge of God, the best there was. And Enosh gave it to his son, who gave it to his son after him, who gave it to his son after him. And in each generation, there was a man all through there who received originally from Adam everything that could be known about God, accurately and with purity. And it was the responsibility of that person to receive and preserve the accurate knowledge of God. That person then, therefore, as a priest, he was the representative of God to the other people because he was the one to whom they would go with questions about God. They had a question about God. One of the other brothers or sisters would say, well, let's go talk to Seth and find out. That would be how that would work. And on down through the generations, there would be even more corruption of the knowledge of God. But one man was expected and selected in each generation. It wasn't just some guy. There was a generation that came along, and a man in that generation was selected by God himself and possibly by his father to be the recipient of the accurate knowledge of God, so that he could represent God as adequately and accurately as possible to his generation. Now, all those generations were living together. Noah was the first descendant of God, of Adam, who was born after Adam's death. All the generations up till Noah were actually, Adam was still alive during those generations. But it was still necessary that there be a son in each generation to represent God to that generation, or we could have said, you left us as orphans. Mm. The reason we're spiritual orphans, the reason we were spiritual orphans, is because we just didn't have access. The access was cut off. And variations and versions of the truth were given, but the access to the real truth was cut off. And God is in that. We're now in the time. You and I are blessed to live in a time when God is saying, okay, we're done with that. An accurate and adequate representation of who I am and what I am is now in the earth again, fully. And we're kind of like who we are. And I know that, you know, people can be very critical of what I'm about to say, and that's just too bad. We are called in our time to recover the knowledge of what it was to be the priest in the generation. We're it. Now, we're in a collective priesthood. Ever since the sons of Israel in Egypt, we have become a collective priesthood instead of the single priest. But all the way down through Jacob, there was a man in every generation, generation after generation after generation, included Noah and eventually Abraham, a man that could be identified as the priest. So, for example, Abram was visited by Melchizedek. You remember in Genesis 12, he was visited by Melchizedek. Melchizedek was a priest of God Most High. It says that in the text. But so was Abram. Abram respected Melchizedek because he was of a previous generation of the priest. And the writer of Hebrews capitalizes on Melchizedek to describe the priesthood of which Christ is the high priest. We are priests, of a priesthood, the high priest of which is God the Son himself. So that's who you are. As pretty or not pretty as you may be. As wicked or not wicked as you may be. Us. We are in the earth today, the priestly representation of God the Father and God the Son in the earth in our time. That's a heavy responsibility, and it sounds like total hubris. I know that. But there had to be somebody. And you just got the tap. God said, you're it. But we're it in a corporate sense now. Man is no longer the individual that he was. We're made to be corporate. Now, you and I are raised in a culture, most of us anyway. I don't know what's going on nearly as well in Kenya, so I'm not going to speak to that. But in America, we're raised in a culture where the individual is everything and the corporate is nearly nothing. That value runs counter to the principles of the kingdom of God. We are in a time, you and I, are in a time when we're called to rediscover, in a sense, a much more accurate culture. And we must be willing, no matter what nation we come from, it doesn't matter. Regardless, whether it be China, whether it be Russia, whether it be Zimbabwe, whether it be Peru, it doesn't matter what nation we come from, it has a culture that is at variance with the culture of the kingdom of God. The culture in which you've been raised, you've learned a lot of things about. And your point of view about virtually everything comes out of the culture in which you were born and raised. That culture inadequately and inaccurately has any sense of who God is. It is your responsibility then as a priest to get to the truth. And the truth is not represented in American culture or Kenyan culture or any of the others. The truth is only represented in the culture of the kingdom of God, which kingdom is a priesthood whose permanent boss is the Son of God. And so it says in Romans somewhere, I think it's in Romans, it may be in Hebrews, you know, you get old enough and the brain doesn't work anymore. It's probably in Hebrews now, where it says, we have come to the church of the firstborn. Mm-hmm. For many years, I believe that that said we have come to the Church of Christ, and in fact, it has influenced Christian thought. No, it's the church of us. We are the firstborn. The generation in which we are its firstborn. That David was the seventh of seven sons, the last son of seven sons of Jesse. And God said to him, "Today I have declared you are my firstborn." You, I, we are the firstborn. That church to which we are come is the church of us, the firstborn. And it's our responsibility then to be the Son of God and to love him as he loved us, which caused him to create all that is. The love of God started the whole thing. The love of God will finish the whole thing. The love of God has inhabited the whole thing, and he's always seen to it. Even though we couldn't see it, he has always seen to it that he was adequately represented in every generation of man. That at the end of the thing, there will be a thing called, there already is, but there will be the phenomenon of the great cloud of witnesses will continue. Never unrepresented is our Father. And the representation is the function of priest in the holy place. That's us. We it. Actually, I think that's good news. I think that's pretty, it's heavy, but I think it's good news. I think I should stop, Santosh, because I'm going long already anyway. I'm not. I think I typically go long.
I love it.